April 17th, 1962, Lecture 41. April 17th, 1962, Lecture 41. April 17th, 1962, Lecture 41. April 17th, 1962, Lecture 41, The Principles of Statistical Mechanics. April 17th, 1962, Lecture 41, The Principles of Statistical Mechanics. April 17th, 1962, Lecture 41, The Principles of Statistical Mechanics.
Last time we began by discussing some of the properties of the large numbers of atoms when they hit each other, large numbers of collisions for a long time, and the subject is called kinetic theory, the description of matter from the point of view of the collisions between the atoms. Fundamentally, everything that the matter does should be explainable in terms of the motions of its parts. However, if we limit ourselves Not however, I leave the however out. If we limit ourselves to conditions at thermal equilibrium and do not try to talk about what happens yet when we're out of equilibrium, that's a subclass of all the phenomena of nature. And the mechanics, the laws of mechanics which apply just to thermal equilibrium, the statistical average theorems and this and that, are called statistical mechanics. And in this lecture, I want to give you some little idea of one or two of the theorems, the central theorems of statistical mechanics, but none of the applications. We've already got one of the theorems of statistical mechanics, and that is that the mean value of the kinetic energy for any motion, or any independent motion, for each degree of freedom, for each independent motion, is 1/2 kT at the absolute temperature T. That's a theorem of statistical mechanics. It has only to do with equilibrium conditions. Today, that tells us something about the velocities of the atoms. Now, today I want to talk about more about the positions of the atoms to discover how many of them are going to be in different places at thermal equilibrium. And also to go into a little more detail, if we can, on the distribution of the velocities. Although we have the mean square velocity, we don't know how to answer a question like, how many of them are going three times faster than the mean square, or how many are going less than 1/4 of the mean square, and how they are distributed. Are most of them got exactly, have they all got the same speed exactly, or are they distributed, and so on. So those are the two questions that we'll answer. How are the molecules distributed in space when there are forces acting on them? And second, how are they distributed in velocity? Turns out that the two questions are completely independent. The distribution of velocities is always the same. We've already got a hint of that when we notice that the theorem 1/2 kT is the average kinetic energy is the same no matter what the forces are acting on the molecules. And the distribution of the velocities of the molecules are independent of the forces because the collisions rates and so forth don't depend upon the forces. But next we discuss the distribution of the molecules under forces. And the easiest example to begin with is the distribution of the air in an atmosphere. Not our own atmosphere, because that's being, you've got winds and all kinds of stuff in it. But we suppose that we have a gas at a very great height in a big column, and which has come to thermal equilibrium. Our atmosphere, of course, as you know, it gets colder as you go up. I don't want that case. I want where the temperature is the same everywhere. So we suppose that the temperature has been gotten into equilibrium through all the collisions and is the same everywhere as a function of vertical height. We make some remarks that if it weren't the same as a function of vertical height, you could get into some trouble by connecting a rod to some balls this way. And now this one would have to pick up 1/2 kT from the molecules down here, and it would shake through this rod the ball up here, and those would shake the molecules up there. So ultimately, of course, the temperature is the same at all heights in a gravitational field. Well, if the temperature is the same at all heights, the problem is to discover how the atmosphere becomes tenuous as we go up. In other words, let n equal the number of atoms or molecules per cubic centimeter or per unit volume. And if P is the pressure of the gas, then PV is the total number of molecules in a, altogether, if the V is the volume times KT, or we can write that as by dividing by the volume as the number of molecules per cc times KT. In other words, you can either measure the number of molecules per unit volume or the pressure. Both will behave in the same manner. They're proportional to each other since the temperature is constant in this problem. But the pressure isn't constant. As you must appreciate, the pressure at this level is higher than at this level, or at the bottom is still higher because it has to hold, so to speak, the weight of all the gas that's above it. And that's the clue by which we'll determine how the pressure changes with height. If we take a unit area, then the vertical force from below on this unit area is the pressure. And the vertical force pushing down, let's call this height h, or this h plus dh. The force pushing down on the top surface is the pressure there. And under ordinary circumstances, those are equal. But now they're not equal because the force from below must exceed the force from above, since there's a certain amount of weight in the, in here, there's a force of gravitation on the matter in this region. So that the pressure at the height h plus dh must be less than the pressure at the height h by the force of attraction of the molecules in that volume. Now, how do I get this crazy thing? Mg is the force on each molecule from gravity, where g is the acceleration of gravity. Ndh is the total number of molecules in that slab, because remember, the area is 1, so the volume is just dh. So the pressure, this is a differential equation. This is the rate of change of the pressure, the derivative. So we find that the pressure change with height is given by minus mg times n. And I prefer to get either all n's or all p's. So if you don't mind, I'll do it all in terms of n. So I replace p by nkt and obtain here kt, because it's constant with the temperature, derivative of the density, or the number of molecules per cc, with height h. So the differential equation that we have now is this one, which tells us how the height goes down as we go up in energy. We have an object, the density n, which is, varies with height, but which has a derivative which is proportional to itself. Now, the object, the function which has a derivative proportional to itself is an exponential. And the solution of this differential equation, you can do it in a lot of ways. For instance, if you want to, you can write dn over n is equal to minus mg. Well, that's pretty good, as a matter. Yeah, mg over kt dh. That's the same as this. Or if you want, that's the same as the differential of logarithm n is equal to minus mg, with the kt here if you want. Doesn't make any difference, it's the same, times the differential of the height. And when I integrate that, that tells me that the logarithm of n goes linearly with the height. Or, if you wish, equally well, n goes as the nth, some constant, which I'll call for a moment n naught and explain what it is in a minute, times mgh over kt is the solution of this differential equation, naturally. If you try it, differentiate it, it'll work. What's n0? It's some constant, but we can see what it is, because if we say that at some height 0, then n0 is the number at the height 0. So n0 is the density of atoms at the height 0. Then the height, the density of any other height goes down exponentially with height. First, let's notice that if we had different kinds of molecules or different masses in here, they would go down with different exponentials. They would, the ones which were heavier would decrease with altitude faster, and the lighter ones would decrease with altitude slower. Therefore, we would expect that in an atmosphere with nitrogen and oxygen, since oxygen is heavier than nitrogen, that as we go higher and higher up, the proportion of nitrogen would increase. Now, this doesn't happen really very much in our own atmosphere, at least in reasonable heights, because there's so much wind and stuff which mixes the gases back together again. It's not an isothermal atmosphere. Nevertheless, as we go higher and higher, there is a tendency for lighter materials like hydrogen and water, hydrogen, to appear at very great heights in the atmosphere, because the lowest masses continue to exist while the other exponentials have all died out. You know how an exponential looks. And if I had an m higher, well, it would be a sharper one, so there'd be, and an m lower would be a longer one. So if you go very far out, you get only the lightest gas if it were isothermal. Now I'd like to call your attention to an interesting fact, that this quantity here is the potential energy of an atom. And therefore, we can also write this particular law in this case, that the density at any point is proportional to E to the minus the potential energy of each atom over KT. Well, that may be an accident. That may only be true for this particular case of uniform gravitation. But I'd like to show you that it is not just that case, but works in any case. It's a more general proposition. Suppose that there was some other kind of force acting on the molecules in a gas rather than gravity. For example, the molecules may be ions, may be charged electrically, and there's an electric field present, or there's another charge that attracts them. Or because of the mutual attractions of the atoms for each other, or for the wall, or for a solid or something, there's some force of attraction which varies with position and which acts on all the molecules. Now, suppose for simplicity that the molecules are all the same and that the force acts on each individual one, so that the total force on a piece of gas would be simply the number of molecules times the force on each one. We're going to get into some trouble with directions and vectors and so on. So to make it easy, let's suppose, because it doesn't make any difference which way we take the axis, suppose for a moment I take the x-axis in the direction of the force. So the force really is acting in the x-direction. This force F is supposed to be the force on each atom. Then in the same manner as we worked out before, if we take a pair of planes in the gas from here to here in the same way and call the distance between them x, then the rate of change with respect to x in exactly the same manner of the pressure will be equal to the force on each atom, but there are n atoms per cc, and this is the generalization of the equation written here, where mg is replaced, of course, by the force. Maybe I have the sign wrong. I suppose, I don't know, I get mixed up, but never mind, it's one way or the other. It certainly is, and it's just a question of thinking to figure out which one it is. It's not a question of principle. Now, P is nkt, so again, I replace this psi by kt dn dx and discover a very important law, which we're going to use later, but we get it, write it down this way. F is equal to minus kt times the derivative with respect to the distance of the logarithm of the number of atoms per cc. What if we actually will use this in a differential form now to continue this thing, and we have this, that f dx is the difference in two places of the logarithm of n. But f dx is the work you would do in taking a molecule from one place to the other. And if f comes from a potential, that is, if the work done can be represented by a potential energy at all, then this thing would also be the difference in the potential energy. I call it PE because I'm getting tired of writing V, V for velocity, V for volume, V for potential energy. It's too much, so we call PE, a function of position of potential energy. The differential for potential energy is the work done, F dx. And this is then the differential of the logarithm, where the sign is minus. Now I know, because I know what the answer is going to be. So I get this. And then when I integrate this, I find the log of n is proportional to the potential energy over kt, and therefore that n is equal to e to the minus potential energy over kt in the more general case of force. And so it turns that it's true in absolute generality. This is another of the principles of statistical mechanics, that the probability of finding molecules in a given arrangement is proportional to e to the minus the potential energy of that arrangement divided by kt. This then could tell us the distribution of molecules. For instance, suppose that we have a positive ion in a liquid and we have negative ions around. They will be attracted to the positive ion. How many of them will be at different distances? Well, what is their potential energy as a function of distance? If you know that, then the proportion of them at different distances is given by this law, and so on for many applications. In fact, I just to talk about it, we're not going to actually do this, but I would like to tell you what the rest of the world looks like. In other words, when you learn more, what you'll be learning about. When you learn the more most advanced statistical mechanics, you have solving the following important problem. Suppose that we have a lot of molecules which attract each other. For instance, suppose we want to include the forces between them, and we suppose that as a function of distance, the force between them is some mutual force like this. That this is the potential energy of mutual force, a function which I will call V of the radial distance between the two atoms. And this means that the energy decreases as they come together because they attract, and then the energy increases when they come still closer together very sharply because they repel, which is characteristic of the way molecules, roughly speaking, behave. Now, suppose that we have a whole box full of such molecules, and we would like to know how they arrange themselves on the average. And the answer is E to the minus the total potential energy, which in this case would be the sum over all the pairs if I and J represent two molecules, and Rij is the mutual distance between the two molecules, and V is a function supposedly known, which represents the force between two of the molecules, and supposing that the forces are all in pairs, there may be three-body forces and more complicated things, but electricity, for example, it's the potential energies all in pairs. But anyway, supposing that, then this would be the probability for the arrangement to finding molecules in different circumstances. Now look, if the temperature is very high compared to any of the important energies in here, this expression is relatively small, and the probability of finding them is almost independent of position. Well, let me take the case of two molecules, just two. Would be E to the minus the potential over KT would be the probability of finding them at various mutual distances R. You see that since the potential goes negative here, this quantity is larger in this region than it is in this region. And since the potential goes toward infinity here, this quantity is almost zero for very small distances. That means if you have two atoms in a gas, there's no chance to speak of that they're on top of each other naturally. They repel so strongly. But there is a higher chance of finding them at the point where they attract best than there is at other points. How important is this higher chance? That depends on the temperature. If the temperature is very large compared to this difference in energy, E to the minus is always a small quantity, and it doesn't make much difference. You're about equally likely to be far out as in here, so that the things just don't care much about the forces. But as the temperature falls, the probability of finding them at the place of best distance gradually increases relative to the probability of finding them over here because of the way the exponential behaves. And in fact, if KT is much less than this, we have E to the plus, a relatively large quantity for finding it in here. In other words, it's much more likely to be at the distance of minimum energy than far apart. So as the temperature falls, the atoms fall together, clump up in lumps, and reduce liquids and solids and molecules and so forth. And as you heat them up, it all evaporates. And the laws for the determination of exactly how things evaporate, exactly what should happen in a given circumstance, then involves the following. First, to discover the correct law of force between the molecules, which must come from something else. It must come from the laws of behavior of molecules or quantum mechanics or what have you. But given the laws of force between the molecules, to discover what a billion molecules are going to do, then merely consists of studying this function. And surprisingly enough, since it's such a simple function and it's such an easy idea given the potential, the labor is enormously complicated and the subject is quite exciting and interesting. Because the difficulty is the enormous number of variables. When you have n atoms, 10 to the 23rd atoms, it looks like a simple function, but it's a function of so many variables that it's an intriguing problem. It's called the many-body problem or other things by other people. And it has really been a very interesting thing, because in this one formula must be contained all the details, for example, about the solidification of a gas or all the forms of the crystals that the thing can take and so on are all contained in that. And people have been trying to squeeze it out, but the mathematical difficulties are very great, not to write the thing, but to take care of handling so an enormous number of variables. All right, that then is a distribution in space. And that is the end of classical statistical mechanics, practically speaking. Because if we know, according to this thing, and we try to solve, that's all we have to do. Because the distribution of velocities is something that we can work out once and for all. And there's not something that's different for the different cases. So the real problems are in here. And that's the great problem. That's the whole main central problem of statistical mechanics, according to classical physics. The distribution of velocity is always the same, and the mean kinetic energy for each degree of freedom is a half kt. But now I'd like to discuss, nevertheless, the distribution of velocities, because sometimes it's interesting to know how many of them are moving at different speeds. And that's what we will discuss now. In order to do that, I'll make use of the facts that I discovered with regard to the atmosphere here and discuss an atmosphere in which, for a moment, if you'll let me, I'll disregard the collisions between the atoms. It's a perfect gas. We've already assumed that when we got part of this law. This law is general, but the one we have here is only for a perfect gas because in the energy here, we disregarded the energy of attraction of the atoms. The only energy that we wrote in, the only potential energy, was the gravity. But it should have more complicated if there are forces between the atoms. But we take, again, no force between the atoms. And for a moment, please, let me disregard collisions. I'll tell you why I can when I'm finished with it. I would like to know how many molecules there are at different velocities, and I have invented a way of obtaining this information. So follow me in the following argument, because the purpose of the argument is only to get the result. It's a rather interesting one. You see, there are fewer molecules at the height h than there are at the height 0, given by the formula that they decrease exponentially with height, as we've just said. Now, how can there be fewer? After all, a molecule which is moving up, all the molecules which are moving up here go through here? No. Because those which are moving up here that are going too slowly don't get up to here. And on that clue, I will tell you how many must be moving at different speeds. Because fundamentally what's involved is that I know that the number of them that are moving to, how many are moving less than enough speed to get up to here? Because those missing ones are the ones that account for the fact that the density up here is lower than here. Now let me put that idea a little more precisely. Let us count how many molecules are passing from below to above this plane. I called it height equals zero, but I don't mean that there's a floor here. It's just a convenient label, zero. The gas keeps on going down still further. There's some gas at negative h, all right? Now, these gas molecules are moving all around in every which way, but some of them are moving through the plane. And at any moment, a certain number of them are passing through the plane from below to above per second. And they're passing with all kinds of velocities. No. I note the following. If I take a velocity u, call u the velocity, which is just needed to get up to the height h, that is kinetic energy mu squared over 2 is mga, then the number which are passing this lower plane in a vertical direction, the total number that are going through the plane per second, whose velocity exceeds u, is exactly the same as the number which passed through the upper plane at all with any velocity. Those are the ones, as long as their velocity exceeds u, they can get through the upper plane. And if it does not exceed u, they will not get through the upper plane. So therefore, I have that the number passing with the z component greater than u at the height 0 is the same as the number that passed with z component of velocity greater than 0, that is, not pass at all, at the height h. But the number which passed through here with any velocity at all at this height is less than the number that passed through the lower height with any velocity, that is, velocity greater than 0. Because the number of atoms is greater, that's all. Because we know already that the distribution of velocities is the same. That was the big little, that was a little argument I made about the temperature being constant all the way through the atmosphere. So since the velocity distributions are the same, and it's just that there's more atoms here, clearly the number that are passing with positive velocity at height h and the number that are passing with positive velocity at height 0 bear the ratio of the densities at the two heights, which is the exponential mgh over kt. Now I would like you to look between the first and the last term of this equality and substitute for mgh mu squared over 2. And then you will discover the following fact, that at the height 0, the following is true. The number passing per unit area per second with a z component of velocity greater than u is the total number that are passing through the plane with velocity greater than 0, is e to the minus mu squared over 2 over kt. Now, this was true at the height h. Of course, it's true at any other height because the distributions of velocities are all the same, and so it has nothing to do with the height, so I didn't have to mention the height, and it's a general proposition. And this gives us the distribution of velocities because it tells us that if we drill a little hole on the side of a gas pipe, in a place where there's gas, I mean, very, very tiny hole, and that, so that the collisions are few and far between, that the collisions are further apart than this diameter of the hole. Then the particles which are coming out will have different velocities, but the total flux of particles, the fraction of the particles which come out, the flux, the particles which come out, the fraction of them that come out with velocity greater than u is e to the minus mu squared over 2 kt. So that gives us a distribution. The first remark is about the collisions. There was something I forgot to say over there, but I can't remember what it is. But I got an uneasy feeling. First remark is about the existence of collisions. Why doesn't it make any difference? The reason is that with this whole property, one way of arguing this would be that to do the same argument, not with a finite height h, but with an infinitesimal height h, where they're so small that there hasn't been time for any collisions in between. But another way to make the argument is this, that this argument is evidently based on an analysis of the energies involved, the conservation of energies. And in the collisions that are involved, there's an exchange of energies among the molecules, but I don't really care that I have to follow the same molecule. If I exchange that energy with another molecule, it's the same thing. So that it turns out, if it's analyzed carefully, and it's quite more difficult, naturally, to do a better job, but if it is done a better job, it doesn't make any difference. And the reason it doesn't make any difference is that all the collisions merely exchange energy and do not obviate the argument at all. So that this is still right. And this then is the, it's interesting that this is e to the minus the kinetic energy over kt. Well, if it gets easier to remember all these things, it's always e to the minus energy over kt. This way of describing the distribution of velocities by giving the number that are passing a given area with a certain z component is not the most conventional way of giving the velocity distribution. For instance, inside the gas, you might would like to know, inside the gas, how many molecules are moving, say, with a z component such between such and such and such and such. And that, of course, isn't quite given by this. This only tells how much the flux is and so on. So we would like to convert it to a more conventional form. And it isn't very important. I don't want to pay much attention to it, to the conversion of this thing, but I would like to just pay attention to the final result. Instead of giving the distribution, the total number that pass from below to above, I'd rather give another idea, which is this. Of course, they both depend on each other. I can get one from the other. Now that I've derived this, I can derive the whole works, as a matter of fact. But suppose that the z component of velocity is called u, but now we're going to describe the distribution in a different manner. We're going to tell you how many particles have, just worry about one component, the z component, of velocity, have z component of velocity, such and so much. Well, none of them have, you know, the big game. None of them have exactly 1.73628911173 so and so and so and so and on forever. Nobody has that velocity. So in order to give proportions, you have to give how many have velocity in some range. Then you have to say, well, how many have velocities between 1.796 and 1.797 and so on. So if we make du fine enough, we can do a pretty good job, but we must remember to include the du in thinking about it and realizing what we're talking about. Let f of u du be the fraction of all of the molecules which happen to have velocity u between, in a certain range, you see, they have a velocity u, but within a range du. You can either call it having velocity u somewhere between u and u plus du, or what's probably less confusing, have a velocity u within a range. du. And I've drawn a picture of how it's going to look. It's going to look like this. And here's the velocity u. And the height of this curve tells us relatively how many particles there are with the velocity. But more precisely, if du is a width here, the area under this curve, which as you realize is f of u du, the ratio of this area to the total area under the curve is the relative proportion of them, or the way I've defined it. The total area under the curve must be 1. Because if the fraction of them having the velocity in this range is given by this area, then the total number must be the sum of all the areas. So the way I've defined things, the integral of f of u du would come out 1. Now we have only to get this distribution by comparing it to the theorem that we had before. You see, the number of molecules passing through an area per second with velocity greater than u will be the following. At first, you would think it's integral of f of u du for all velocities higher than u. But it is not, because we said the number that are passing an area per second, and the faster ones pass more often, so to speak, than the slower ones. In order to find out how many pass, we have to multiply by the velocity. We've already discussed that when we talked about the number of collisions. In a given time, t, the total number which are passing through the surface are all of those which have been able to arrive at the surface. And the number which have arrived, they come from a distance u times t. And so the number which arrive is not simply the number that are there, but the number that are there per unit volume, multiplied by the distance that they sweep through in racing for the area through which they're supposed to go, and that's proportionally u. So that it should be integral of u, f of u du overall, an indefinite integral with a lower limit u. And this should be e to the minus mu squared over 2kt. And I don't worrying about constants now. There are various constants. These are all proportional to these things. We'll get the constant later from this proposition. Now, if we differentiate an indefinite integral, we get the thing that's in the indefinite integral. And if we differentiate the other side from the derivative of the exponent, we get a bunch of stuff times u times the same exponential. And now the u's go away. And the constants we're not paying any attention to. And so we find that f of u is a constant times e to the minus mu squared over 2kt. I've left the du in here just to remind you that it's a distribution, so-called, and that would tell us what the proportion are with velocities between u and u plus du. The constant c must be determined so that the integral of f of u du equals 1. If I have time at the end, I'll show you how to determine that constant without borrowing anything from the mathematicians. But at the moment, I'm going to borrow something instead. There's a mathematicians can prove that the integral from minus infinity to infinity of e to the minus x squared dx is the square root of pi. And we'll oppose it that. We know that. Anyway, it's some number. And then by putting this integral in here and fiddling around with the variables, you can show that the constant has to be this particular constant, or square root of m over 2 pi kt. Not an important point. The important point is that the distribution is e to the minus kinetic energy over kt. So the probabilities of finding particles with different velocities, I prefer to say momenta for a certain technical reason, to think in terms of momenta instead of velocities if you want. It's not important. So the distribution of momentum is e to the minus kinetic energy over kt per unit of momentum range. It was really written in per unit of velocity range, but they're proportional, of course. The reason is it turns out that this theorem is true in relativity, too, if it's in momentum, while if it's in velocity, it isn't. It's just one of those little gimmicks that I have always. So you memorize the right one, you see. So you don't have to learn something new. So that if you learn it in momentum instead of in velocity, it'll be all right. And so you see the probability of different conditions of momentum, of energy, whether kinetic or potential, are both given by e to the minus energy over kt, a very easy thing to remember. A rather beautiful proposition. We have here, of course, only the distribution of the velocities horizontally. We might want to ask, what is the probability that one is moving in other directions, and so forth, and so on. And of course, they are connected. And one can immediately obtain, obtain the complete distribution from this alone. Because the complete distribution certainly depends only on the square of the magnitude of the velocity. This depends on the length. It doesn't depend upon the x component. It must be something that's independent of direction. So there's only one function involved, the probability of different magnitudes. And here we have the distribution of the z component. And the two things, therefore, one from one, you can get the other. But I won't chase the mathematics along with it. I'll tell you, though, the very interesting result, that the probability is still e to the minus the kinetic energy over kt. But now the kinetic energy involves the x component, mv sub x squared over 2, mv sub y squared over 2, and mv sub z squared over 2. And so it's a product, because it's e to the power. And therefore, since the power is the sum of the kinetic energies in the three directions, it's a product of a function like this for the, say, z direction, a same kind of a function for the x direction, and a same kind of a function for the y direction. And so the distribution of any one component is the same as all the others. All the components move independently But anyway, the idea is that it's e to the minus, its probability is e to the minus kinetic energy over kT. And that, then, are the two great theorems of classical statistical mechanics. Now I would like to discuss some matters to test the theory and to see how successful is the theory, classical theory of gases. Perhaps to come at it more straightforwardly, just to make sure that I talk about the most important things first, I leave something to come back to. We talked about the gamma, which was this. If gamma minus, if U is the internal energy of all the molecules, then PV, which is equal to the number of molecules times KT, is proportional to U sometimes for some gases, maybe. For sure, if it's a monatomic gas of single molecules, we know this is also equal to 2/3 of the kinetic energy of the center of mass. Now, if it's a monatomic gas, then the kinetic energy of the center of mass is equal to the internal energy, and therefore gamma minus 1 is 2/3. But suppose it's, say, a more complicated molecule that can spin and vibrate inside. And let us suppose, thing which is, turns out to be true according to the classical mechanics, that the internal motions, the energies of the internal motions, are also proportional to KT. Then when a thing has a certain temperature, it has a certain kinetic energy, all right, but it's got more total energy than just the kinetic energy because it's got internal vibrational or rotational energy. So the total U includes not just the internal kinetic energy, but also the rotational energy and so on, and so we get a different value of gamma here. The best way to measure gamma is by measuring the specific heat, which is the change in energy with temperature, and that's what I'll leave for later, but it doesn't make any difference. Suppose we measure gamma by looking at the PV to the gamma curve. Anyway, we'll talk about how you measure gamma later. But let's make a calculation of gamma for some cases. First, monatomic gas. Well, then U is the total energy is the same as the kinetic energy, and we know already the gamma should be 5/3. Now I'm going to take a diatomic gas. I'm going to take as an example, for instance, oxygen or anything. Hydrogen iodide is as good as anything. Oxygen, hydrogen. I'm going to suppose that the diatomic gas can be represented as two things held together by some kind of force analogous to the force here. And I'm going to also suppose, and it turns out to be quite true, that the vibrate, that this curve, that they sit at the temperatures that are interesting for the diatomic gas, they mostly sit near the bottom. If it weren't true, if this probability weren't strong enough to make the great majority sit near the bottom, we would have to remember that oxygen gas is a mixture of O2 and pure oxygen atoms in a reasonable proportion of regular oxygen atoms. But we know there are very few single oxygen atoms. That means that most of the atoms must be, that the temperatures, that this potential energy is higher than KT, and they must be sitting in here. If they're sitting close in here, the only part of the curve I need is this part. I replace it by a parabola. Potential energy of parabola means a little harmonic oscillator. So, and it's true that to an excellent approximation, the oxygen can be represented as the two molecules, or the hydrogen iodide, two molecules connected by a spring. Now what's the total energy of this molecule at temperature T? We know that for each of the two molecules, each of the kinetic energies should be 3/2 kT. So the kinetic energy of both of them is 3/2 kT plus 3/2 kT. We can also put it a different way. The same 3/2 and 3/2, which is the kinetic energy of this and this, can be also looked at as kinetic energy of the CG, 3/2. Kinetic energy of rotation around this way, 2/2, I'll show you why. And kinetic energy of vibration, 1/2. We know that the kinetic energy of vibration is 1/2. There's one dimension in there. There's one in each degree of freedom has 1/2 kT. We know that all the total energies is 3/2 plus 3/2. So when we break it up, it'll certainly come out like this. Also, if you want to argue about the rotation, it can either turn this way or that way. There are two independent motions. So we get this much. We're not discussing the rotation around this axis. We suppose that the molecules are some kind of points and can't spin about that. a point to come back to, because if we get a disagreement, maybe that's where the trouble is. But we have one more thing, which is the potential energy of vibration. And how much is that? In a harmonic oscillator, the average kinetic energy and the average potential energy are equal, and therefore the potential energy of vibration is 1/2 also equal to kT. A grand total of energy of the whole thing, 7/2 kT. That's the total energy U, while the kinetic energy is 3/2. At any rate, the total energy U is 7/2 kT, or kT is 2/7 of U per atom. And that means then that the gamma is 1 2/7 instead of 1 2/3, which is 1.286. Now we look to see if it's true. And I have here collected from the handbook, chemical rubber handbook, the specific heats of various gases at different temperatures. So we look first at helium, which is a monatomic gas, and it's very good. The error is probably experimental, although at such a low temperature, maybe there are some forces between the atoms which are important. Anyway, it's darn good. It should be 5/3, which I remind you is 1667. Krypton agrees also within the accuracy of the experiment, as well as argon, all monatomic gases. Then we turn to the diatomic gases, and we find hydrogen with 1.404, which does not agree with the theory. Oxygen, 1399, very similar, but again, not in agreement. Hydrogen iodide, again similar at 140. It begins to look as if the right answer is 140, but it isn't. Because if we look at bromine, we see 132. If we look at iodine, we see 130. 130 is getting good. So we're doing all right with iodine, but we're not doing all right with oxygen. So now look, how can you beat it? I mean, you got it for one molecule, you haven't got it for another molecule. It's going to be pretty ingenious in order to avoid this. Furthermore, if we take a more complicated molecule with large numbers of parts, and I've taken as an example C2H6, which is ethane, then it's got eight different molecules, and they're all vibrating and moving and turning and so on. So the total amount of energy in those must be an enormous number of kT. So the gamma over 1 must be very close to 0. Gamma should be almost exactly 1. Well, it is lower, but it isn't so much lower. It's only 1 2/9, and that's ununderstandable. Furthermore, the whole mystery is deep, because even if you thought that it had to be 140, see, people thought, well, let's throw away the vibration for some reason or other. Let's suppose it's rigid. Legally, it can't be made rigid by a limit, because if we made it stronger and stronger, it doesn't vibrate much, but it still keeps vibrating. And the energy inside is still 1 kT. It doesn't depend on the strength of the coupling. But if you can imagine it, absolute rigidity, that is just not allowed to move, there's no such a variable, then we would get 5/2 and 1.40. On the other hand, we wouldn't be too happy, because if we looked at either, I have both hydrogen and oxygen here, whichever you want to look at. Let's look at hydrogen. If we look at it as a function of temperature, then we really get into trouble, because at this temperature, it's 1.40, which is fine. But as it heats up, the thing gets to be closer to 1.29. And if the thing cools down, it begins to go up on the other side. It's more substantial in the case of hydrogen than in oxygen. But nevertheless, even in oxygen, there sees a tendency to go up as you go down in temperature. So all in all, we might say that we have some difficulty. Now you say, well, let's suppose it isn't a spring, let's suppose, and so on. It turns out that everything you'll suppose will only make this thing higher. Include the rotational energy, and you include more energy. The bigger this coefficient is, the closer the gamma ought to be to 1. The real trouble is that it's too big. The gamma experimentally is too big. All the theoretical things that you can think of will only make it worse. The fact is that there are electrons in this atom, we now think. We know that there are spectra, that there's internal motions. Each of those should have a kT, at least half kT of kinetic energy, and something for the potential energy. So when you add it all together, still more, still more, still more. It's ridiculous. It's wrong. And in the first paper on the dynamical theory of gases by Maxwell, he had a summary at the end after he did all the wonderful things with it, and he showed how good it was, and it got the pressure, and it got Boyle's law, and it got all the laws. It got the diffusion theory, and it got all the viscosity and things we'll talk about next time, and he gave a whole list, and at the end he said, finally, by establishing a necessary relation between the motions of translation and rotation, he's talking about this Hare-KT theorem, of all particles not spherical, we proved that a system of such particles could not possibly satisfy the known relation between the two specific heats. This gamma, I'll show you later, is related to the specific heats. So he's talking about the gamma, and he says, we know that we can't get the right answer. 10 years later, in a lecture, he says, after talking about the subject again, he says, I have now put before you what I consider to be the greatest difficulty yet encountered by the molecular theory. These words represent the first discovery of man that the laws of classical physics were wrong. This was the first inclination that there was something fundamentally impossible, because a theorem which guaranteed proved, and every time you just keep checking it and checking it, it was always right. There was nothing wrong with the derivation. But it doesn't agree with experiment. And about 1890, Jeans was to say, talk again about this puzzle. I like to hear people who say that the physicists of the later part of the 19th century, all they thought they had to do was calculate more decimal places and so on. Maybe one guy said that once, and everybody copies it. But I've read an awful lot of what these fellows say, and they all are worrying about something. And Jeans says about this thing that is a very mysterious phenomenon, but it seems as though as the temperature falls, certain kinds of motions freeze out. You see, if we could imagine that this vibrational motion didn't exist at low temperature and did exist at high temperatures, then we could sort of imagine that we're going to passing from the 140 at a temperature at which this vibrational motion doesn't exist to a temperature, a higher temperature at which it begins to come in. And the same might be argued for the rotation altogether. If we could eliminate the rotation, say it freezes out at sufficiently low temperature, then we could understand that hydrogen is approaching 166 as we go down in temperature. It does approach 166 as you go still further down. So the motions are freezing out. And then how do they freeze out? Of course, they froze out in a way that cannot be understood by classical mechanics. It can only be understood by quantum mechanics. And so without proofs, of course, I will tell you what the results are of the quantum mechanical theory. You remember that according to the quantum mechanics, we said that when they have a system which is bound, as for example it would be in this potential, let's talk about the vibration, for example, there will be a set of energy levels, states of different energy. Now the question is, what does statistical mechanics look like according to quantum theory? It turns out, interestingly enough, although most problems are more difficult in quantum mechanics than in classical mechanics, the problems of statistical mechanics are much easier in quantum theory. It's a very, very simple result of all classical mechanics and is the following very important theorem. If the energies of these are called, say, E0, E1, E2, and so on, let's say EI is the ith one, we can ask in thermal equilibrium, what is the condition of the atom? Well, all the different molecules will be in different conditions, or on the average, you'll have different probabilities of different circumstances. And the great theorem is that the probability to find it in this level, in this particular state, in a state having energy EI, is less than to find it in some other state with some other energy in accordance with the following. Just take the energy of the state and divide by KT, take E to the minus that. That gives the probability of being in various states. As that, in other words, the relative chance, the probability of being in this state relative to the chance of being in that state is E to the minus E1 over KT divided by E to the minus E0 over KT, which I needn't remind you is E to the minus E1 minus E0. So it's more likely, it's less likely to be in one state than another. The ratio of the number of atoms in the upper to the number of atoms in the lower state is E to the minus the energy difference over KT. A very simple proposition. Now, it turns out that for a harmonic oscillator, the energy levels are all spaced, it turns out, very nicely, evenly. And the spacings, calling the lowest energy zero, which is necessarily isn't the zero here, it's a little different, but calling the lowest energy zero, because the absolute value doesn't make any difference. And the first one is at H omega naught. And the second one, it turns out, is at 2H omega naught. And the third one is at 3H omega naught. And so it goes for a harmonic oscillator. That's what comes out for a vibration. Now let's see what happens. Let us ask the relative chance to find an atom in this state relative to this. The answer is E to the minus H omega over KT. In other words, the chance to find in this state relative to this goes down as E to the minus this this energy H omega divided by KT. Now suppose that KT is much less than H omega. We have a low temperature circumstance. Then the probability to be in this state is extremely small. All the atoms are in this state. If I change the temperature but still keep it very small, then the chance of being in this state remains infinitesimal, but the temperature changes. But all the atoms are still in this state, and the energy of the oscillator remains zero. It doesn't change as I change the temperature, as long as the temperature is much less than H omega, because they're all in the bottom, and the motion is frozen. And there's no contribution of it to the specific heat. We can judge then that at 100 degrees centigrade, which is 373 degrees absolute, KT is less than the vibrational energy of the oxygen or hydrogen molecule, but not so of the iodine molecule. The reason for that is this. Iodine atom is very, very heavy. I picked it. I knew I was going to get it right, but the iodine is very heavy. And the hydrogen is very light. And although the forces may be comparable in hydrogen and iodine, the molecule is so heavy that the natural frequency of the iodine is very low. Natural frequency of the iodine is very high. So the H omega is very high, and higher than room temperature for hydrogen, but lower than room temperature for iodine, and so iodine shows the vibrational kinetic energy, and the classical theory and the other one does not. Furthermore, as we increase the temperature, after a while, if we increase the temperature, then it does begin to have an appreciable probability to be in this state, and finally in the other states, and so on. And when you get a probability to be in all the states, the answers approach the same answer as classical physics, because you can't see anymore the fact that the thing has to be quantized in energy. It can have almost any energy when the temperature is high enough. So as the temperature rises, we should again get the results of classical physics. And you see that as the temperature rises, it does approach quite the right result. It is also possible to show in the same way that the rotational states of atoms are also quantized, but much finer. They're closer together. So under the most ordinary circumstances, the rotation states, the KT is bigger than the spacing. The KT may be this big. And so many levels are excited, and you do get the rotational kinetic energy in the system. The one example that isn't true is the hydrogen there, for example. And so that's the difference. And now that was the way it was discovered. This is the first time that we have really deduced that there was something wrong directly by experiment with the classical physics. And this is the resolution of a quantum mechanics. It took, of course, 30 or 40 years before the next difficulty was discovered. And that had to do, again, with statistical mechanics, but this time of a photon gas. And that was solved by Planck, which gave the correct clue for the rest of the analysis. Thank you. Does that satisfy you? Well, I'm going to get the right answer and see that it's wrong. I mean, I must be honest. None of this shit you see about doing it wrong. Because I'm glad I had the energy levels and it was easier to say this.
Yeah.
Oh, God, no.
What is it?
Who wrote this?
I don't know.
Well, it says, for different gas molecules in a box at equilibrium, the center of mass, kinetic energy, it should be a square there, the different types of molecules are equal for each. We proved that. This is also true if the types are separated by a partition. Then it says temperature is defined by that, and therefore the temperatures are equal. No, it's in equilibrium, therefore the temperatures are equal.
Yeah, right.
Then we proved that the kinetic energies are equal. Therefore, we can define the temperature by this, which is sounds like a minor rearrangement, but the idea is completely reversed. Well, there's nothing we can do about it. We'll get the notes out, we'll have everything right.
So this has to be squared.
Well, that's one point, but the logic of this is backwards.
When are we going to take photographs?
Of what?
You.
What for?
I don't know.
Want to make a movie?